That was a beer opening.
Ah, nothing like a good Pabst.
No, no, no. Shout out to the People's Pint in somewhere Massachusetts, Greenfield, Massachusetts, in their Franklin Farmhouse. I've told you about this one before. It's quite tasty.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I happen to be enjoying the canoe paddler, traditional Kolsch from Leinenkugel's.
Ah, you've told me about that, Kolsch.
Very nice.
This is an oddity for us because, and if you listen regularly, you know this, we typically record on a weekend morning and we're drinking coffee.
Right.
So, nice to have a beer while we're talking about beer.
Mm-hmm. What you got today?
What I got today? Well, let's see. Let's do a couple housekeeping items first.
Housekeeping.
We have been asking for a while now submissions for our little contest here to talk about folks, to talk with folks, rather, who are looking to...
No, we're going to talk about them.
Oh, well, yeah. We'll don't tell them until we talk about them.
Okay. Right.
You're giving away all the secrets. We've had a lot of submissions. Thank you for wanting to get on with us and talk a bit. We're going to stop taking submissions now. We'll go through what we have, and we'll be reaching out to some of you kind folks who have volunteered your time and probably your sanity to listen to us talk about what we have to say about your plans for hop production. So we'll probably get that going in the next couple of weeks. So expect to hear something from us about that toward the end of the month by the time it all gets to recording and publishing. So that will be fun.
Excellent.
For us, it will be anyway. We might make some people cry.
Yeah, well, that's, I call that a Tuesday.
Cool. Yes. Fair enough. And let's see. What episode did we drop the other day? Talking about the things that consumers say to brewers. So that episode's been out, and I have a little bit of distressing news.
Uh-oh.
We've got about 100 downloads on that one in 3 days, which is about the rate that we see when something first drops before things really start to accelerate. Not a one from Lithuania.
What?
Maybe it's a national holiday this week?
Could be.
I don't know, but I was running the numbers this morning, and I got a little concerned. Maybe we've been blocked.
Ernestus, you have to help us out here. You have to... What? I mean...
He could be on vacation.
You don't suppose something's wrong with him, do you?
I hope not.
Let us know you're okay.
Mm-hmm. We want to know you're right with it. There were a handful... I don't have the numbers in front of me. There were a handful of downloads from other parts of the world. Maybe he's on vacation and he's touring.
Oh, maybe.
And he's downloading from other places is the other possibility. But we'll continue to monitor this situation. And if there are any issues here, we will be sure to let everyone know how Ernestus is doing and if everything's okay once we learn more.
I mean, because we could always start a GoFundMe for him. You know, if it's just reach out.
We may need to. Right, buddy. We hope you're doing well. So... Before we get into our topics of the day, I know you and I both, we are, as Hopnology, we are members of the Brewers Association.
Yep, proud members.
Proud members. And it's a good thing to join. They have a lot of great publications, a lot of great information, and it supports the community, the brewing community. So they put out a publication every month or two months called New Brewer, and it's a great, great read. And they had an article that I was reading today on small format packaging. And it was all about 8-ounce cans, 10-ounce bottles, little packaging, which, you know, we've talked about this. And I was using the example of that Vietnamese coffee stout that I took a chance on a 4-pack of 16-ounce cans. And it was a mistake.
That's a commitment.
It is. And you've got breweries that are starting to lean in the other direction. And some of them are doing it with lighter, low-alcohol fare, like a Kolsch, where it's a snack, the way they called it. It made me laugh. It's a snacking beer.
Yeah.
The flip side to that is on a very high-alcohol beer, if you don't want we used to call them pounders back when the 16-ounce cans first came out and we were shotgunning them. Mm. But... that's an alternative there as well. And I think it's an interesting move in the other direction because, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, everything was bottles. Now all you're seeing are these 4-packs of 16-ounce cans. And now we're going back the other way, very far the other way.
I think that's awesome because for me, I mean, well, you know, we've talked at length about how you are a sampler. You want to try everything, mm-hmm. right? And I am maybe less so because it's like, well, I know what I like and blah, blah, blah. But I do like some of these experimentals. I want to be able to have that experience on my own time. So I'd like to be able to get some of that stuff in much smaller packaging, right? Give me a double Imperial Baltic Porter, but give it to me in 8 ounces, for God's sakes.
Yep, I think it's a wonderful idea. One of the breweries referred to the way they push it out there as a flight to go.
Yeah, nice.
Which is such a clever idea. To your point, I love samplers. And that's a great way of doing it. There was one quote that I had to share directly from the article. One of the brewers said, I'm a new dad, and I realized that drinking a 750 milliliter Imperial Stout was no longer conducive to being a functioning father.
Oh, that is so fantastic.
It is, and it's 1,000% accurate.
Totally. Well, and as the quote athletic beer scene starts to grow, mm-hmm. the low alcohol, low calorie craft beer scene, do you really need to be drinking 750 milliliters of an Imperial Stout in one go? No, because you already had your 1,000 calories for the day. You don't need any more. Mm-hmm. So I think it's cool. I would love to see where this goes. And, you know, if we want to take a minute and tie that back to the grower, what that means is if breweries see a lot of bandwidth here, you know, like market acceptance of this trend, that would allow them to get into packaging at smaller volumes and smaller levels that would allow them to be more experimental with, you know, local ingredients. Or what are you doing as a small grower if you're looking now at a packaging brewery, but they're doing it in very small, limited release? That's good news for you.
That's an interesting thought. The logistics part of it I hadn't thought of. I wonder, though, if it's, I mean, certainly volume, you're putting less volume out there, canned. I wonder how much labor it actually is if you're doing your own canning and labeling and all that. Is it really that much less work to do an 8-ounce can than a 16-ounce can? I would guess it's not.
No, but I don't think they're in the game of volume. Because they'll be, I mean, if I were them, I'd be up charging the hell out of that. Because a flight to go, are you kidding me? 8 ounces? And yeah, I mean, as a total checkout price, it's going to end up being less than your 12 or certainly your 32-ounce crowlers. But per ounce or per deciliter that you're selling, you could make bank on that. And people would do it just for the novelty and you pay the extra fee, so to speak, to have less beer. Brilliant. I love it. Where do I invest?
And you know,
shut up and take my money.
If you look in the soda aisle right now, you know, 12-ounce cans is the way it's always been, and you buy them by the sleeve or by the six-pack, but you're also seeing those little 8-ounce cans. Mm-hmm. And they are very, to the point you just made, they are very expensive relative to the volume in them.
It's a convenience fee. Mm-hmm. You're like, I don't want a Hulk soda. Can I have, I will gladly pay you for 2/3 of the volume, but at twice the price.
And I'm sure that I can smuggle 4 8-ounce cans of beer into a movie theater much easier than 2 16-ounce cans.
Oh, totally.
So there's that.
So I've heard.
Yeah. Yeah. Those 16-ounce cans bulge in all the wrong places when you sneak them in.
And we don't have to sneak in Wisconsin because you can buy beer in the movie theater. So there you go.
What have I always said? That line from Lewis Black. Yeah, you're not alcoholics. You're professionals.
Mm-hmm. We pride ourselves on it.
Yes, you should. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's just a little detour into packaging, but I think it's so interesting, and I agree with you. There's money to be made there, and I love that idea of a flight to go. Absolutely.
And you know, we're gonna get techie here in a minute, but I would be interested to know from our listeners, you know, format wise, would you like a 10 minute before we get deep dive into production issues? Should we break up the podcast a little bit? Should we, or do you like, you know, all technical in one episode and all, you know, brewing and industry stuff in another episode? Or should we, you know, have snippets? Let us know.
Yeah, that, you know, it's a good point bringing that up, because we have the last couple of episodes done some bits and pieces combined. And I know from my perspective, that's because this, you know, this piece I was reading today on the small format packaging, I wanted to talk about it before I became less passionate about the topic, because I was into it today. It was just on my mind.
Right.
So let's hear from everyone. What do you think? Would you rather we stay more focused on a thing at a time, or does the bouncing around keep you engaged as well? Alrighty. So the big topics for today, we'll get into some some science and, you know, nature. Every time I go outside, I get nature on me.
I know. Nature's all over you.
We had a spider infestation yesterday. Oh, my goodness.
Infestation there were two spiders?
No, the driveway was covered. Jill my wife would not pull into the garage. She was afraid to open the garage door because the spiders would get in. I've never seen anything like this. This was amazing.
It sounds like a bad movie from 79 with Ernest Borgnine in it.
It looked like a horror film, and we've been talking about it all day. Thank goodness it rained today, and you know, out comes the sun and dries up all the rain.
Yeah, I knew
tomorrow
you were going
they'll be
there.
Back.
I knew that was coming.
I stole the joke from my daughter, but it was scary yesterday. So speaking of nature, I read about this thing. I hope you can explain to me, called biodynamics.
Yes, Greg. I'm happy to. Okay, what do you want to hear from me? Do you want to hear the Wikipedia explanation, or do you want to hear the perspective of an environmental biophysicist?
Well, I did a little bit of reading, so let me tell you what I think it
oh,
is
so
from
you,
what
you,
I've
you,
read.
You've already been to Wikipedia, is what
I've been
you're
to Wikipedia.
Me. Okay.
And so biodynamics, if I'm reading it correctly, sounds like the idea that you should be able to do everything, have a self-sustaining system without having to add things and remove things, that nature is a wondrous, beautiful thing, and it should work entirely on its own with no external inputs. Mm-hmm. So why shouldn't I be able to have a farm, and that includes both crops and livestock, where I'm using the waste from one to take care of the other, and everything lives together in harmony? It sounds like a wonderful concept.
Sure. Sounds great. Same thing. I mean, you could do the same thing in indoor grow systems with aquaponics, right, or permaculture, as they call it, where, you know, you've got plants and fish, and the fish eat something, and, you know, they like to say, well, the fish are going to nibble on roots of the plants, and then, you know, they poop, and then the plants take up the fertilizer, you know, from the poop, and then the plants grow, and then the fish eats the roots, and blah blah blah, and it's a lovely, glorious cycle, except for one problem. It's a singular issue. That's it. Just one thing. The law of thermodynamics. And the same thing, I'll explain what that means. The same thing goes for cropping systems in this popularized idea of biodynamic. Now, this is a topic in which I am extremely literate. As those of you who know me and know my background, I did my graduate work at UW-Madison in a field called environmental biophysics. And basically, that's a fancy term for, because Greg knows how I like to make stuff up, that's a fancy phrase for measuring all the inputs and outputs of living systems, specifically, in my case, cropping systems.
So to your point about making stuff up, I did Google biodynamics, and at first I was sure you had created all the websites for it just to lead me down a path, but I'm fairly certain this is a thing.
I am flattered, actually. That you would think that I would go to such lengths in order to pull one over on you, because I would.
I know you would.
So thank you for that. That makes me feel good. Right. So let's talk about it, because we hear this topic more and more frequently now. And sometimes it's mixed in with the with organic production or natural production or holistic agriculture. And these are all buzzwords, but I thought what we ought to do is take a minute to talk about what does this biodynamic mean, what we think it means, right, in our popular view, and what it really means from the science end, so we can start getting our nomenclature straight. And then I think it would be a good segue into what we really want out of this idea of biodynamics in our production system and how we can get it. So stick with me here. It's time to science. Mm-hmm. All right. So think about it like this. You're growing hops. You put a plant in the ground and you expect it to grow. Well, it's not going to grow without inputs, right? So what are the inputs? Throw some at me. Water is an input, right?
Water, you mentioned thermodynamics before, so temperature.
Temperature, yep. So energy from the outside, so sunlight, right? You can't mm-hmm. photosynthesize without sunlight, kind of the definition. Nutrients, so it needs food, right? The yep. plant wants to make sugar through photosynthesis, but it also needs all these other nutrients to build proteins and stuff like that, so... All of that activity, right, are inputs to the system. Inputs to your growing system. What are the outputs of that growing system? Well, as the plant grows, it's going to put on biomass, right? It's going to put on leaves and stems and sidearms and all kinds of stuff like that. Flowers, for the love of God, I hope there's flowers. And in those flowers, there's all these really complex compounds that we talked about in our drying study episode. Putting all of those individual molecules together from carbon and hydrogens and oxygens and nitrogens, all that stuff that the plant's taking up as inputs, that takes energy. So that's another input. Where's that energy coming from? Well, it's usually coming from the sun. In order to have outputs, all of this biomass that grows from the ground all the way up, how do we balance that out? We have inputs that are going in. It's like balancing your checkbook. You got to have enough inputs going in so you can cash that check and have enough outputs going out without bouncing the checking account, right? Mm-hmm. So let's think about that in terms of biodynamics. This concept that nature has figured this out already. And I'm a huge proponent of that. Even in commercial agriculture, I say, look to Mother Nature because she's been doing this a little longer than we have. And we look at balances, you know, whether it's predators and pests or diseases in the environment, if we look at what Mother Nature did, that doesn't mean that we can, if we want to be profitable, if we want to have a commercial yield, that we can just sort of let hop plants grow as Mother Nature intended. Because the plants that we are growing now are a far cry from the spindly little wild-type things that were growing out in the woods 1,000 years ago.
So as we try to optimize for that one part of this equation, we're going to create sub-optimization in other parts of the equation.
Yep. And you can't go from the spindly thing that's flowering to reproduce. That's the only reason plants flower, and it's the single most energetically expensive thing a plant will ever do. By orders of magnitude. You think about all the energy that must be required for a plant to grow from nothing to, you know, 6 meters tall in 8 weeks. It's a huge amount of energy. Mm-hmm. But that's nothing compared to the amount of energy it takes to form flowers and the chemistry. So we are focused entirely on yield. And for hops, that means flowers. And that means the single most energetic thing a plant needs. So that means if we're going to take out of the system the single most energy intensive component of a plant, that means we have to be putting in a ton of energy. Does that make sense?
Yep, it does. And if this is a closed system, that ton of energy you're putting in is being, if this is a circle, is mm-hmm. being created in some fashion by the outputs of your hop plant. So connecting those dots
right.
is incredibly complicated.
So if this was a truly this mythical fable of, you know, a closed system, what you end up with is you'd say, all right, well, these flowers put all this energy into flowering. We've captured the energy from the sun. Well, right there, you're taking energy from outside a closed system. Mm-hmm. If you were to, what would happen if you put that plant inside of a dark room and gave it everything else it needed?
What would work?
No, exactly. Well, then you're like, well, I'll put lights in there. Okay, that's fine. You can, but those lights are being powered by something. So you have energy from outside the system.
I guess I would make the argument that solar energy is free.
But it isn't. So here's the issue. That solar energy, when we talk about free means that when energy comes into the system, you're able to, on the output of the system, you're able to capture that value and reuse it. That makes it free.
I guess what I'm saying by free is by using it, we're not depriving it from some other process it would have contributed to.
Oh, so now you want to change the rules of biodynamics to fit your own philosophy is what you're telling me.
Sure.
Right. Okay. Well, that's not where I'm at. I told you we were going to science the shit out of this, and that's what we're doing. So all that energy that's pent up in those flowers and all that biomass, let's say you did nothing with it. And people say, well, James, what happens is all that stuff's going to rot away and I could compost it, right? And I could gain all of that back and put it back in my field, and now it's a closed system again. Wrong. Why is that wrong? Well, during the decomposition process, the physical act of decomposition, whether it's aerobic or anaerobic, meaning with or without oxygen, you're giving off gases, usually CO2 of some sort. That flashes off into the atmosphere. So if you wanted to capture that CO2, you could, but that carbon in the carbon dioxide that's flashing off came from carbon that the plant took in as CO2. But you're also losing gobs and gobs and gobs of heat energy as that decomposition takes place. That, just feel a compost pile when it's cooking. I mean, it'll be 120, 130 degrees Fahrenheit.
Oh, it's white steams, sure.
Yeah, exactly. That's energy. All that energy is leaving the system. So just by composting and then putting that compost back on the field, you are not completing a cycle of any sort. You have lost a huge amount of energy out of that system.
Now, we are trying to envision this as a pretty small closed system, mm-hmm. with, you know, A creates B, B creates A.
Right.
As opposed to the Rube Goldberg system that most of nature actually adheres to, mm-hmm. where it may go through. So there's a much bigger picture here.
Correct. So I think that's why we need to talk about the semantics. When we talk about biodynamic production, what we really want to be thinking about is minimizing as many external inputs as we can to the point where the production still stays economically sustainable, i.e., you can still get a harvestable crop of appropriate quality while maintaining as much as possible a input-output level as close to the baseline as possible. You're never going to hit it. You will never hit it. And people will say, well, what's the best way to do that? What's the best way to make sure that my inputs and my outputs are as balanced as possible? There's gobs of different ways. Just like you said, it's a Rube Goldberg device. So there's hundreds of inputs and hundreds of outputs. How you balance those depends hugely on your production system, how you choose to operate. And that's it. That's purely it. There's nothing else to it. And there's gobs of data and calculations and whatnot that we can look at in production systems to know, where do I get my biggest bang for my biological buck?
And, you know, we've talked a lot here about the how biodynamics and the what, but there's the why side. Mm-hmm. And this is a sustainability thing, that word gets thrown around way too easily. Mm-hmm. But, and that's why I use it, because I know it makes you kind of cringe and clench a little bit. I heard a clench.
You did, yeah. And it wasn't just my jaw.
No. I think it was quite a bit lower than that. But the why part of this is important, because this, to me, resonates very closely to the organic argument, which is this is it's better for the environment, it's better for the future, and therefore I'm going to do things that are better for nature in my view. And then the moment we start talking about the economics of it is when other people start to clench.
Right.
But this podcast, I believe, is in the business category on iTunes with the four of you who have rated
right.
us.
Right.
So that's always going to be a part of it. There is, I would say, knowing much less about the biodynamic side of things than you do, I would say there's always a way to make it work to a degree. But like you said about the spindly, you know, emaciated hops, if that's what you're going for, is to prove that a system can sustain itself, you can make this happen. You're not going to make any money off of it.
And notice, I never prefaced any of the discussion with that. Mm-hmm. That's why I always say, people say, well, James, can I do X, Y, and Z? I'm like, you can do whatever you want. But what you really want to know is, can I do this and expect to be successful as a hop grower? Mm-hmm. And usually the answer is no, because you can't shortchange the system. You can't expect to get 2,000 pounds an acre dry by giving the system half the fertilizer and half of the water that it needs to get there. Mm-hmm. Because you think you're doing something good for the environment. That's a totally different argument. And that's not what I'm arguing right now. I'm not even arguing at all. We're just talking about facts. So you've said sustainable, and I'm going to unclench a little bit. This concept of sustainability, you know, like, hey, I want to have a sustainable farm, or, you know, we have to have a sustainable infrastructure. But like, that's bullshit. There is no such thing as sustainable in the pure scientific term because of the laws of thermodynamics. Everything tends towards chaos. It's called entropy, which means that all order will move to disorder. There's nothing that we can do to create a perpetual motion machine. It will not work. So this concept of sustainability, when somebody like me hears this, I just smirk, because you can't do that. What you can do is you can optimize and balance your system to recover as much energy out of the back end that goes in the front end, while maintaining enough economy from a business sense in order to allow you to continue to do business. Mm-hmm. That's really what we're talking about. So when we think about, I want to have a sustainable hop farm, what does that mean to you? Because there isn't a box where you can finally say, yep, I did it, check, I have a sustainable hop farm. Nope. It's all about your inputs and balancing them with your outputs and what allows you to continue to do this. That's it. That's all sustainability is. It's a function of this concept of biodynamics and figuring out what are the big inputs that make the big outputs, and how do you get the biggest bang out of those inputs so you can minimize them on the front end, but know that you can get a big one on the back end. And like vice versa, which ones can you skimp on up front without really hurting anything in the back end? That's right. Those are the people who win the race.
There's always going to be some work to be done. Yep. There's always going to be, and you know, we talked about this on the more pragmatic episodes, where we're talking more about the blocking and tackling. But to your point about a sustainable system being one that's like a perpetual motion machine, it almost feels like a lazy request.
Right.
There is no set it and forget it hop
farm. No, none. And again, it's not like, you know, I work. It's not like you're scoring points in a video game, and when you get to a certain level, you unlock a new skill. No, it doesn't work that way. There's two really big inputs that are absolutely critical to outputs in your hop yard, and that's fertilizer and water. Because to your point, Greg, sunshine is free, right? There's some optimizing of the trellis and stringing structure that can improve yield. But the two biggest things that growers have impact over are control over are fertilizers and water. water we've talked about in the past. We'll talk about it more in the future. So I want to talk about irrigation setups and all that kind of stuff. But for fertilizers, fertilizers are enormous in terms of hop yield. There's so many people, and they're starting to come out now, and hopefully from listening to the podcast, that say, wait a minute, okay, I went back and listened to some of your fertilizer and nutrient episodes, and I started doing my calculations, and I realized, no wonder I'm not getting any yield, because I'm putting on 20% of the fertilizer that I need. Yep, that's right. Like, so walk through the math with me. So, you know, I was putting on 15 kilos of nitrogen fertilizer at 8% over my 200 or 300 crowns. I really should have been putting on 187 kilos. Yeah, that's right, Batman. that math checks out. Like, oh my God, how much fertilizer do you use for, you know, 30 or 40 hectares? You use wagon loads. And so then people start freaking out because they start looking at all this fertilizer coming in from off their farm, and they see, you know, granules. They see manufactured fertilizers. I don't want to call them synthetic because they're not synthetic. They're made from the air. And if you think air is synthetic, we have another discussion to have. So,
yeah, there's a few other podcasts I can point you toward.
Exactly. So most nitrogen fertilizers, at least the good ones, are made from air, which is 78% nitrogen, as opposed to biological materials like ground up fish. So you see these fish emulsion fertilizers, you know, it's all organic, 100% natural. It's at best 8%. But it's natural. So is the air. What's the problem? Well, you had to use different mechanisms in order to get that turned into a fertilizer. What, you think the fish jumped out of the ocean, wiggled across the ground, and are going to die on your hop yard? No. So let's get our philosophies straight and understand that, yes, too much of a good thing is never a good thing, right? With too much manufactured fertilizer.
How am I supposed to find a picture of a fish wiggling across the ground to use on Instagram next week? I don't think it's possible.
You're the social media guy, not me.
Oh, Lord. I want to know how you get in the business of selling something made of air also, because that sounds like the business to be in.
Marshmallows? I don't know. So this idea of fertilizer being manufactured fertilizers being somehow bad for the environment, and natural-based fertilizers, i.e. fish goo or blood meal or feather meal or manure being good, we have to stop. It's just ridiculous. If you start looking at what we call embodied energy of those systems, and you do the math, what one finds out very quickly is that manufactured fertilizers not only are generally much cleaner sources, but have the lowest embodied energy of those fertilizer sources, whereas these natural byproducts actually end up having higher, in some cases, embodied energy, how much energy it takes to get it to you, even though in some cases, like blood meal, it can be a waste product or feather meal. That doesn't mean they're bad sources of nitrogen. Not by a long shot, they're not. But let's be honest about what you're trying to do. That goes back to what you said earlier, Greg, about the organic discussion. It's a philosophy. Mm-hmm. And it's what toolbox are you going to take tools out of? The organic growers who adhere to that philosophy have a very small toolbox, and they've committed themselves to only using tools out of that toolbox. Pure conventional growers have a totally different toolbox. Biodynamic growers, I would like to think, if I were growing, I like to think of myself as a biodynamic farmer. I was taking tools out of everybody's toolbox because I'm going to take what works best for the situation, and understanding that the less energy, in farming, energy is money, that I can put in the front end to get a yield on the back end is what I'm going to do. I don't care if it's considered organic or not. But if we force ourselves into these pockets and into these tribes of production, you really are limiting your potential. And I just advise people not to do that.
Good advice. And I do think so much of it, as you mentioned before, just like the organic thing, it's mindset. It is the belief that you're doing something better for the holistic whole by making these decisions. And there's nothing wrong with that as long as you're informed and you really know what those decisions are, what the ramification of those decisions are.
There's so many different branches we could go off of here. It really does come, somebody will say, well, James, I've got all this compost available from a guy down the road, and I'm going to use that on my fields. Okay, why? Well, compost is good, right? It can be. It can be also very, very bad, depending on who made it, what it's composted from, and whether or not your soil and plants need it. Just because it's natural doesn't mean it's good for what you need. Water hemlock is natural. It didn't work out for Socrates so well. So, well, I mean, come on. The idea that we can use compost as an absolute cure-all elixir, CBD. Sorry, I had something in my throat there. Cure-all elixir that, you know, is going to turn your system into a biodynamic powerhouse is garbage.
Well, compost, I kind of go back to that whole closed system idea and the set it and forget it perpetual motion machine. Isn't it just an easy button? Because you've got that stuff anyway. You mentioned something before with some of these some of these natural fertilizers being natural byproducts.
Right.
And to some degree, isn't that the, I'm trying to put my mind in the minds of folks that lean toward those, and that the mindset is probably something along the lines of, well, there was no excess cost, not a monetary cost, but a cost to the environment of creating this product because something else was being generated anyway, and this was thrown off and would have been thrown away. So it's a zero waste situation. Whereas there may be something else that's being manufactured that's a better fertilizer, but it's being created specifically as a fertilizer, and therefore there are all these other components going on, all these other costs of you know, to nature and economy-wise and whatnot. Does that make any sense? That byproduct side, I think, is where a lot of people look at it and say, well, this had no additional footprint to create because something else was happening anyway.
I think that is probably the number one ideal. And I composted heavily on the farm because I had all this other biomass I had to do something with. What, am I going to cart it away? No, I'm going to land spread it. Because, yeah, guess what? I can get half of my potassium back. People are like, oh, great, that means I can spread half the potassium that I would need next year. No. That means I get it back. It doesn't mean it becomes bioavailable. Doesn't become available to the plant that's going to be taking it up because it's still locked together in all of these biological molecules that's in the plant material. So it's not a panacea. You can't get something for nothing. And in this case, you're not. You're losing a lot of nutrients during composting due to leaching. So you're like, oh, hey, I got all this, you know, if I put all this fertilizer on my hops and then I'm using all this biomass for compost, I'm going to get all that back. No, you're not. Because as those biological compounds break down, they become water soluble and they leach away into the groundwater. So you're really only getting a fraction of the amount back that you put on. Like, oh, I didn't think about that. Well, it's really good for the soil. It is. It can be good for the soil if you have poor soil health to begin with. But if you don't, what are you doing? Well, you know, if it's a good thing, it can't hurt to put it on, right? Well, maybe. Maybe you don't. That compost that you bought from the guy down the road who's got a chicken farm and he mixes it with sawdust, how do you know he's got the right carbon and nitrogen ratio in there? Because if he doesn't, and there's way too much carbon from wood chips and not enough nitrogen, you spread that on your field, and when you put your fertilizer on, all of the microbes that want to eat all of that wood fiber are going to steal your nitrogen and your plants are never going to see any of it. So when people say, hey, I'm going to use this compost, I'm like, that's great. What's the chemical analysis? Well, I don't know. It's compost. Uh-huh. well, as soon as you get back to me, let me know. He's like, well, the farmer, the guy who makes it, gave me this analysis sheet from 8 years ago.
All I want to know is, will it kill the spiders?
Yeah, will it kill the spiders? Nice. Just because it's natural doesn't mean that you can use it with impunity and not expect to have to do math, because it matters. Same thing with you know, if you're using organic sources of fertilizer and blood meal and bone meal and feather meal, bat guano, chicken manure, cow manure, I don't care what it is, you need an analysis, because you need to treat it like a manufactured fertilizer coming out of your cooperative, because it has a nutrient balance. And as we know, if you put too much nitrogen on at the wrong time during the production season, you're going to screw up your chemistry.
Yep, it's natural. It came from nature. Nature is wonderful at self-correcting and has a lot of stuff that kills other stuff in it.
Yep, this concept of circling back around to biodynamics being let nature do it because she's figured it out. Yeah, she has, but look at the size of the operation she's running compared to you trying to tell her that, no, I want this plant that usually grows really spindly in the edges of the woods near streams to grow in really high densities in this one plot and to yield 100 times more than it ever would left to its own devices.
You know, I like what you said there about it being a much larger system and you're just a piece of it. It's, you know, pull out your liver and your spleen, connect them to each other and see how they work just independently like that without everything else.
I mean, yeah, who doesn't need an extra liver lobe? I'm me, but it's just not a plug-and-play system. And this concept of biodynamics is fine if you understand that your little corner of it doesn't really play by the same rules of your larger Mother Nature vision. And it's something that I see so many growers stumbling over because they want to, it's sort of like this, you know, do no harm thing. But, you know, they're like, oh, yeah, I can... farming is so energy intensive, but I don't want to, you know, I want to tread really lightly on the environment. Okay, I appreciate that. I do. What does that mean? It's not hocus pocus. It's not black magic. It's not, you know, kumbaya and drum circles. It's science and it's math and it's paying attention and it's educating yourself.
And to put it in a more physical sense, I mean, you use the word tread lightly. So as you and the listeners probably know at this point, I'm very involved in the Boy Scouts with my son. And tread lightly and leave no trace are the cornerstones of that. But the idea of going out in the woods and coming back from the woods and having zero impact, it's just not possible. No. It's absolutely not possible. You try. And the catchphrase is the very cute, you know, take only pictures, leave only footprints. That's great, but you are having an impact. There's no question about it. You can't avoid it. All right. So if anyone out there is still listening and and believes in biodynamics, they're probably crying.
Sorry.
Or writing you a stern email.
I don't read those.
Well, I know. I get them all. Then I have to find the right time to break the news to you that, you know, our one listener in Denmark has left.
It's not hocus pocus. It's not black magic.